Once again, a warm welcome to Venerable Ajahn Brahmavansu, our dear Ajahn Brahm. And at the outset, we would like to acknowledge Venerable Ajahn Brahm is in Sri Lanka because there was this international Buddhist conference organized by the World Supreme Buddhist Congress. And we were very thankful to the organizers for allowing us to grab 2 days from his schedule. He corrected me by saying he was kidnapped. And yesterday we had a very interesting discussion and a talk here. We are thankful to the Honorable Prime Minister for providing this facility and extending a special invitation to Ajahn Brahm for this program yesterday and today, and to the very supportive staff of the Temple Trees premises and the organization of the Prime Minister's office. And this program is streamed live via Dialogue TV on Dialogue Aksyata through the Ajahn Brahm Society Facebook page. If you have your friends who are not here, you might want to quickly update. Once again, a kind reminder, the digital devices to be completely made silent. Today, Ajahn Brahm will speak to us on the importance of meditation and how and why we should practice. And then for about 55 minutes, then about 20 minutes of guided sessions, and then 30 minutes of Q&A. Over to you, Bhante. Thank you.
And thank you. And to Venerable Mahasangha and brothers and sisters in the Dhamma, it's also a great joy to be able to come here and talk about especially meditation, the art of relaxation, keeping the mind calm and peaceful. And I'll begin with a story which I heard many years ago at a conference on meditation which was occurring in Sydney. And there a professor from Stanford University, one of the top universities in the world, had been doing research into meditation. And he was asked to compare the results of meditation with the results of other forms of relaxation. Now, Stanford is a very wealthy university, and so he managed to get funding for this experiment. He used a large number of his students, and half of them he sent to a meditation day. The other half he sent to a California spa, where they had massages, hot baths. I've never been to a spa, but I think you understand it's very expensive, and it's a way of relaxation. And at the end of the day, the 50% who went to the spa were compared with the 50% who went to meditation retreat to compare who was the most relaxed. And the results were so clear. Without any doubt whatsoever, those who went to the spa were far more relaxed than those who went to meditation. And that alerted me to what type of meditation are you doing? Because when I meditate, I get very relaxed. And many of my students get very relaxed when they're meditating. And in fact, when I teach meditation at retreats, the first couple of the days, when I see the people meditating, they're so relaxed, half of them are asleep. At least they're relaxed. And later on, they overcome what we call sleep deficit, because many people are not sleeping enough. And no, just that much, being able to relax so you get a good night's sleep, that solves so many health problems in our modern world. Not just health problems, but emotional problems. To this day, you know, it's my understanding is, I could be exaggerating, but I think there's a lot to be said that because people don't sleep enough, they don't know how to relax, it's one of the reasons of greater incidences of things like cancer. People are too tired. Not just that, but incidences of depression, and even more so, that we are more angry with one another. I think you all know, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, if you're not rested and relaxed, we don't have what we call resilience. And to give you the example, when you're really stressed, you are like a guitar string. When the guitar string is stretched at both ends, a tiny ping, and it makes a very high-pitched noise. When you loosen the tension on the guitar string, something hits it, it makes a low-pitched sound. When there's no tension on the guitar string at all, when it's loose, something hits it, it doesn't make any sound at all. It's the same with us when we're very highly stressed, pulled tight like a guitar string. Small things make us upset. When we're much more relaxed, yeah, they can still get a reaction out of us. But when we're really relaxed, there's no reaction at all. We're resilient because we're relaxed. So part of meditation is learning how to relax. Because of that, it has been my role, one of my missions, to change people's perception of meditation from something which you don't look forward to doing. Oh my goodness, this is going to hurt. You mean I have to sit on the hard floor for hours on end? And I have to keep 8 precepts, and I have to sleep on a hard bed. And in fact, the harder the bed, the better it's going to be for me. The Buddha did teach something which you know is called anapana sati, mindfulness along with the breath. The Buddha never taught anapana sati, mindfulness along with pain. That has nothing to do with Buddhism. And indeed, recently, I was saying this in the car on the way here. Recently in Singapore, an elderly gentleman came up to me. He asked his question. He said, I'm in my late 70s. I really want to learn meditation, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I cannot stand the physical discomfort of having to sit cross-legged on the floor in full lotus, with a straight back. And going to sleep on the hard floor, and having to get up early in the morning, and having to stay up late at night. He said, I don't think I can stand that at my age. And obviously I told him that that has nothing to do with meditation. Meditation is to be able to sit in a comfortable position, even in a chair. Even with cushions underneath, if you consider that our Lord Buddha, that where did he meditate to become fully enlightened? Under a Bodhi tree. Before he sat under the Bodhi tree, he had a very good meal. A meal which was made for a heavenly being. And he got grass from a grass cutter to make a nice cushion under his bottom so he could sit on. He was under the shade of a tree, a very leafy tree, the bow tree. And also, any of you who've been to what's called now Bodh Gaya, formerly Uruwela, on the banks of the Nirmala River, I was fortunate enough to go there in 1973. And there was hardly any people there. And even though there was quite a few buildings, I can imagine what that was like when the Mahant's Palace was not there. It was on a riverside. It was a beautiful garden. It was like a park. And to me, that would have been such a beautiful place, cool, fresh, comfortable, for our Lord Buddha to meditate. And of course, he attained full enlightenment. In the same way, these days, it's important that people can meditate in comfort, especially those people who are elderly or who are sick. Those are the people who need it probably more than anybody else. So at least in the last years of their life, they have the opportunity to learn meditation. So to change the perception of what meditation retreats are, I usually nickname my retreats Club Med. So today this is Club Med Temple Trees. Because Club Med, as many of you know, is short for Club Mediterranean. It's a resort complex. It's a place where people pay a lot of money, not to be tortured, but to relax. And so, this is Club Med Temple Trees this afternoon. And Club Meditation. And it's there to learn how to relax the body, first of all. And from there, we learn how to relax the mind. In the meditation retreats which I do, I make sure I don't have one of these. It's not very good, but anyway. Okay, that's much better. Because I recall when I was a young meditator, you know, sometimes I was getting nice and peaceful and calm, and then as soon as I was just about to drop into deep meditation, and sometimes I wonder, what would have happened to our Lord Buddha under the Bodhi tree if somebody got time to come out? So I prefer to make the meditation natural. So those, sometimes you don't want to meditate very long. It doesn't feel right to go more than 10 or 15 minutes. And sometimes you want to meditate for many hours. So don't have any bells disturbing you. What I call no bell silence. No bell silence. And sometimes when sometimes we have noble silence, we have some people actually win the no bell peace prize. Deep meditation. So when we keep it natural, whenever we can, today the guided meditation, we have to have a bell, because otherwise, you know, this place will have to be used afterwards. You have to go home for your other appointments. But we make it comfortable. So the first thing to do in our meditation is to find a comfortable position for your body. Now this is where we start to use two qualities, which we call mindfulness, awareness. But mindfulness by itself is not enough. It has to be mindfulness together with kindness. And if you ever want to check up on this, it's in Manipadayaka Samyutta, where the Buddha was told by this heavenly being that mindfulness is a wonderful thing. Through mindfulness you can get rid of ill will. The Buddha said, mindfulness is a wonderful thing, but you need more than mindfulness to overcome ill will. You need also kindness as well. Those two together, mindfulness and kindness, according to the Buddha in that sutta, is important for you to relax the body. Which is one of the reasons why, in order to make this very clear, coined a new word. It's wonderful to invent new words, and that was not mindfulness, not kindness, but kindfulness. Mindful together with kindness. Now how that works is you're sitting down in a chair, on a cushion, wherever you need to sit down. You close your eyes, you're aware, but you're also kind. How are you sitting? An example of that is when people sit down sometimes they've got itchy throats and they need to cough. But what do people do? No, I should not cough because I will disturb everybody else. And we get a phenomena which I call in meditation the volcano effect. Instead of coughing straight away, we suppress it, we stop it, and the itch, the irritation gets stronger and stronger and stronger, like in a volcano. It's plugged up, and the force, the pressure gets stronger and stronger, and it's going to blow. And like a volcano, when it does blow, there's a huge boom! It's important I do things like that, boom, because when you're giving Dhamma Desana, some people fall asleep. So a little boom wakes people up during the lecture, during the bhana. And also, the worst part is not just the explosion, but all the toxic gases and lava, which covers the villages surrounding the volcano. Now, when you cough, the same thing happens. You suppress it, you plug it up, it's gonna blow. When it does blow, you can hear it, you know, all over Colombo. Well, that's exaggerating some way, but at least the whole room hears it, and all of that toxic fluid from your throat goes all over the people around you, which is very unhealthy. So the point is, if it's a cough, just cough. It's much better than suppressing it. And if you're worried about people, oh, it's making a sound, it may be disturbing others, it would only disturb them if they're very tense. So I say, like the guitar string, if they're so tense, they'll get irritated and angry. But if they're following the instructions, they're relaxing, it's just a cough. And it disappears almost immediately. 1 second, maybe two. Our problem is, if we're very tight and very tense because we don't know how to let things be, we will find that the cough finished a long time ago. We're still thinking about it. Who was that? We should stop people who have irritable throats from coming into meditation retreats. We should have one of those scanners like they have at the airports to see anyone who's got a tight fever is not allowed into this room. Only healthy people can come into this room. No coughing is allowed. One cough, two coughs, three coughs, and you're out. Now, people actually think like that, and they go through all these thinking scenarios, and they find out the cough stopped a long time ago, but they're still echoing in their mind. That is the problem. So when we're kind and we're soft, things don't irritate much, which means our body can relax, and other people around us don't get so disturbed. But to relax the body, the mindfulness and the kindness, so we can feel our body, that's called the awareness. The awareness of the body, feeling it. How does your body feel right now? What part of your body is the most irritating in this moment? Once you focus on an irritating part of the body, it's not that hard to relax it, to give it so much kindness that it starts to relax. When I was a young boy, growing up in Acton, in the West London, a poor part of that place, because most of my friends were migrants. My father was very poor, legitimately poor. So we used to spend so many hours playing soccer in the street. When you play soccer, football, in the street, you go for a tackle, you fall on the ground, and you kept scraping the skin off your knees. So I always remember, bloody knees with scabs on them when I was young. And when I used to do that, see the scabs, fall over and graze my knee, I'd go running to my mother straight away. And my mother would kneel down to a maybe 8-9-year-old child, and she'd put her mouth on the open wound to kiss it better. I never knew any better. Now I think, how on earth did that wound not get infected when someone put a mouthful of germs on an open wound? But it always healed up. My mother's, but most importantly, the pain disappeared immediately. Just the mother's love was one of the best analgesics, taking away the pain from a 6 or 7, 8 year old kid's knee. And always remember that the power of compassion to take pain away. It relaxes. And much of pain is tightness, inflammation. It's an overreaction often of the body. So, when I had an irritable throat, or for example what happened in Korea a couple of years ago, having a cold. Woke up in the morning, it was minus 15 degrees, snow everywhere, and my nose was dripping, snot. I don't know what the correct word for it is, but that's how I grew up with that, just with the stuff from your nose. So, nasal fluid, mucus, whatever you call it, to be polite. So, all this stuff was coming out of my nose, and I only had one half an hour, and I was going on live TV for an interview in NKT, that was South Korean TV. And it's basically not done to go on TV with stuff coming out of your nose. So I had half an hour. So what did I do? Sit down, meditate, focus on the irritable sinuses, focus on them, not force this sinal fluid to stop, but just be kind to it, opening the door of my heart to this irritating, really like imagining my mother kissing a wound, to just relax it, let it be kind, be compassionate, there, nose, everything will be okay. And it works. I've used that a lot in my life. To be able to perform in public, you have these little tricks. If I cough now, if I really cough, it's very dangerous for me. Because this happened once when I was in Australia. I coughed in public at the beginning of a talk. By the end of the talk, there was about 8 or 9 bottles of medicine in front of me. And people said, you must take this. This is Ayurvedic. It's very good. This is homeopathic. It's much better. This is herbal. You have to take this. I took this. This is, usual medicine. You've got to take that. I had so many medicines. And, being compassionate and wanting people to, to make merit, I said, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. So I had to take every of those bottles of medicine. And that really made me sick. So now I just learn how to just to lose my mind, compassion, to actually to not cough, not sneeze. Otherwise, you'd give me so much medicine it'd make me sick. But anyway, it works. It's amazing just how you can, mindfulness and kindness, you can relax the body. Now, something happens when you relax the body very deeply. It's better than going to a spa. And you save so much money. You can really relax the body. You can feel it. Because mindfulness gives you feedback. In the same way you may be driving your car through the traffic. Maybe this simile doesn't really work in Colombo because there's too many traffic jams. But imagine you're on a freeway because in places like Australia they have speed cameras. Do you have speed cameras in Sri Lanka? I don't think you need them, do you? You can't go fast in Colombo. Too much traffic. But anyway, in Australia, there's so many open roads, you can go very fast. They have speed cameras. So you have to be very careful. So the speedometer will give you feedback. And so you know the pressure you put on the accelerator. If you're going too slow, you push it down further. If the speedometer goes too high, you loosen off the pressure. The speedometer gives you feedback, so you know how much to push down, how much to let go, to keep the car going at the correct speed. In the same way, that the feeling in the body, the ache, the pain, the tension, the irritation, that gives you feedback. Once you're mindful of that, aware of that, to know how I can relax it. What makes it more tense, more tight, more painful, more irritating? And what lessens the irritation? And that becomes a very powerful method of relaxing the body and healing yourself. It is my understanding, my own experience, that sickness doesn't come from nowhere. The body gives you many warning signs. But we're so unmindful, so unaware, we don't actually see it. Until it's too late. Or until it's very late. So anyway, we can actually learn about our body, feel it, understand it, and know how to relax it so deeply that many, many diseases, many, many deep irritations can disappear very easily. In meditation, we learn how to relax our body deeply by being aware of it, being kind, relaxing everything, so your body is sitting there just so relaxed. Now, there's something which happens when your body gets relaxed. It's one of the reasons why people do spend a lot of money going to spas or resorts. The reason is because it's delightful. It's enjoyable. The pleasure of having a nice, relaxed body. How many of you in the morning, and you don't have to go to work, it may be like a poor day, full moon day, holiday, so you don't have to go to work that day, and you know, you can go to the temple later on. You're relaxing in bed, cozy, comfortable, you just don't want to get up. You're cozy and warm, relaxed. That's very pleasurable. The same when you're sitting meditation, and the body is so relaxed, it is delightful. You focus on the delight. You don't try and get rid of it. Some people think if you're enjoying it, it must be something wrong. No. If you're a relaxed body, it's good for you. It's healthy. So you're sitting there, the body's really relaxed, and you enjoy the delight of a relaxed body. And you find that the relaxation goes deeper. When you notice the delight, it relaxes even more. It's an interesting phenomena which we use later on in meditation. The delight becomes a vehicle to further relax. So you do that with the body first of all, until your body is just sitting here, just very comfortable. And sometimes you look, this is my 67th year now, and my body is just really nice, really healthy. It feels good. And you ask monks in the monastery where I live, when was the last time I... A long time ago. Other monks get sicknesses, flus and stuff. Not me. I really miss out on life. But I like missing out on sicknesses. So there you are. Your body's really relaxed. I'm sitting there, totally relaxed. So now the body's been dealt with. Now we do the same in our emotional world, our mind. The mind, see people say, well, what is the mind? You know, in Buddhism it's the sixth sense. What actually is the mind? What is a garden? We know a garden because of what exists in a garden. Trees, bushes, flowers, little paths, garden benches. A garden is defined by what exists in it. The mind is also defined by the emotional things which live in a mind. Kindness, compassion, love, peace, anger and fear, they're all the weeds in the garden we call the mind. That's how we know what the mind is. In particular, peace or agitation. These are two very important plants which exist in the human mind. And at this point, I'm encouraging people to focus on that more than any other quality in the mind. to ask yourself, even as you can ask yourself now, you don't need to speak it out, but just ask yourself, the number from 1 to 10, how peaceful, how agitated are you? 1 means really peaceful. 10 means agitated. So, ask yourself, from 1 to 10, how peaceful, how agitated are you? I don't care what that number is, but you have just been looking at what I've called the peaceometer. Not the speedometer, the peaceometer. That quality in your mind which indicates how peaceful you are, or how agitated you are, or disturbed if you like. Once you're mindful of the peaceometer, what makes your mind more agitated? Which moves that needle further up to being really, really disturbed. And what calms that mind down, moves that needle closer to 1? What you are doing here, you're mindful of one of the most important parts of meditation. How peaceful you are, how agitated you are. And you start to understand, what is it that causes the needle to go closer to 1? What causes it to go up to 9 or 10 or 11, 12, 13, be really agitated, go off the scale? And you will find the cause of peace, emotional peace, and the cause of emotional disturbance, mental disturbance. You'll find that for yourself. You'll find what it is kindness. The same thing which relaxes the body, relaxes the mind. Opening the door of your heart to this moment. Being kind to this moment, caring for it. Wanting, trying to get something, trying to get rid of something that will move that needle up to 8, 9, 10. You become agitated. Let things be. You relax. The same way your body relaxes, that's the same way the mind relaxes. For those of you who know your suttas, where is this said in the suttas? Third Satipatthana. Mindful of the qualities of the citta, agitated or peaceful. And also, what is the cause of these things becoming more agitated or more peaceful? The Vaya Dhamma and the Atagama Dhamma, coming and going. So the Upada Dhamma and Vaya Dhamma, how these things arise and pass away. What causes them? You're understanding how your mind works. And that's really important when you start the meditation. Because so many people, when they say, oh, I've got to watch the breath, I've got to scan the body, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, that's far too much work and busyness. And sometimes, yes, you start watching your breath. After 5 or 10 minutes, actually not that, 5 or 10 breaths, you can't do any more. And so you struggle. I've got to watch my breath. I'm going to really watch my breath. And you get more tense. That's not meditation. It's supposed to be relaxing, become really peaceful. So when you do this preliminary, it's what in even Anapanasati we call arousing, mindfulness. Get the mindfulness up first of all. Be peaceful and you find you're aware. Now one of the things which is how we become peaceful is when we let go of the past and the future. We don't worry about things which have happened in the past. We don't start thinking about all the problems of the future. You'll find when you start dredging up the past, that needle, the piezometer, goes up, more and more agitated from the past. Or we start thinking about the future. Oh my goodness, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? I wonder if there's any left. If I'm going to make the plane this evening. I wonder if I can, what's going to happen when I get my biopsy report tomorrow? I wonder what's going to happen in the traffic. Will I get there in time? What's going to happen to the stock market? What's going to happen with Kim Jong-un? Maybe there's a missile on its way to Colombo right now. Maybe it was meant to go somewhere else, but it's coming here. Who knows what's going to happen? Bam, bam, bam. Can you see how agitated the mind becomes through fear? So it is important to be able to, when we start meditating, to let go of the past and the future. Otherwise we're not mindful. Mindfulness always lives in the present moment, or the past or the future. So people find it so difficult to let go of the past or the future. How do we do that? Through kindness to the past. You try and get rid of it. I don't want to remember the past. I'm not going to worry about the future. I'm not going to worry. You worry more. There's an old simile, which I've used a lot. So much so, I was saying, Ben on this avenue, it's been plagiarized in a cartoon done by an American gentleman, The Anger Eating Monster. The anger eating monster is this. There was a king who was off somewhere, probably on a meditation retreat. And while he was on a meditation retreat, this big, dangerous, scary monster came into his palace. And the security, you know, we have wonderful security in around temple trees. But if it's a real dangerous, scary monster, all the security, they run over the walls. They hide under the cars. They go, you know, over the walls to hide. Because this was one scary monster. And that allowed the monster to go right into the palace and sit on the emperor's throne. And at that, the security guards got really upset and said, "Get out! You don't belong on that throne. Who do you think you are? There's our empress's throne. Get out now!" Are those few unkind words, angry words, and angry gestures, even unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more frightening. And every time they threatened that monster, "Get out now," the monster just got bigger and bigger and bigger, more stinky, more ugly, more frightening. And when the emperor came back, the king came back, the reason why he was the king was because he was really smart. So when the king came back, he looked at this huge monster. It was massive. And it was so frightening. And the smell which came off this monster's skin was so foul that even maggots crawling on his skin vomited. Not even maggots could stand the smell. But the king knew exactly what to do. Said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit. Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? Good Sri Lankan tea with tinkiri." And he was really kind. Like some hoppers. And straight away, with sincere kindness, the monster shrank an inch. Got a little bit less violent, little less frightening, little less smelly. And all the people in the palace understood their mistake and what they should have been doing from the beginning. They just gave so much kindness, so much compassion to this monster. Every act of kindness, the monster shrank, got less violent, less aggressive, less frightening. Until that monster was soon down to the size when he first came in. But they carried on with the kindness, with the compassion, until the monster was so small that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. That's based on a story told by the Buddha of the anger-eating monster. It feeds on ill will. "Get out of here, you don't belong." Just makes it bigger. Fear is an anger-eating monster. Fear of the future, fear of what's going to happen to you with the cancer, with the finances, with your relationship, with whatever. "Get out of here, you don't belong." The past is also anger-eating monster. I don't want to know the past. It gets stronger. You're feeding it. welcome, monster. Thank you, past, for coming to visit me. Thank you, future. Then it gets softer and softer until the past and future vanish totally away. By the angry eating monsters. And you're peaceful. You've got nothing to worry about. People always say, it's so easy being a monk, you don't have to worry about anything. Ha 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 ha. Oh, I've got bhikkhuni monasteries to build in England. I've got to make sure the bhikkhunis here in Sri Lanka are respected and acknowledged. I've got to, all these problems with committees and I've got so many monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen to look after. Oh, I'm a crazy monk. Why do I do all of this? Why not? So, you're kind to the past, kind to the future. Just let things happen. Go with the flow. I'm trying to fight my karma. I often think I must have been a very, very, very lazy monk in my last life. Because now I have to work really hard to make up for it. Sometimes I wonder, what am I doing in Sri Lanka? You've got so many monks in Sri Lanka. Why are you importing monks from Australia? And I figured out a long time ago, it's because of my English heritage. I've got to repay all the bad karma which the English people did in this country. But anyway, just you have fun, you enjoy, you know, your fate. So you're kind to the past, kind to the future. Which means they disappear. And then you can be in this moment. When you're in this moment, it's so easy. Once you're in this moment, then you can start watching things like the breath, looking at your body, whatever you need to do. You know, a lot of times, if you ever, you watch the farmers planting rice. A lot of that work is in preparation, making sure those paddy fields have just got enough water and just making the little overflows so it doesn't get too much, waiting for the right time to get the seedlings in first of all. Preparation is so important. If they just go planting, you know, seeds of rice any old place, of course it won't grow. Preparation before you start doing things like watching the breath. You prepare first of all, get yourself really comfortable, get the body relaxed, relax the mind, let go of the past and the future. Then it's quite easy to watch the breath. It's not a problem. In fact, it happens quite naturally. Why? Why is the breath probably the most common form of meditation object? I often wondered that and discovered that maybe the rhythm of my breath, going up that rhythm, I remembered that from the time I was in my mother's womb. Imagine you're a baby, not baby, of like a fetus in the womb. You can feel your mother's tummy going up and down, the rhythm of the breath. And then the first few weeks of your life, breastfeeding on her chest. It is a rhythm which is recognized as warm, safe, comfortable, familiar. A very easy rhythm to be with. So it's delightful being with the breath because it's a very comforting sort of rhythm. And also, when the body is really relaxed and the mind sort of has lost its past and the future because it's disappeared, a lot of time it's the only thing left moving. Everything else is quiet except for so we just start watching the breath. You know that sometimes people used to say, well, where should you watch the breathing? Should you watch at the tip of the nose or your belly? Where should you watch it? I was fortunate because my father had asthma that I have hay fever. And because I had hay fever, my nose was often blocked. I couldn't watch the breath at the tip of my nose during, you know, the hay fever season, July, August, October, or sometime, September, October. So I was so happy that now you could watch the breath at your belly, you know, the Burmese method. But then when I was a monk, that was so difficult. The first years as a monk, I became a monk when I was only 23, a young man. And so in the evening, you know, we didn't eat anything after midday. So when I started observing this area, I wasn't watching my tummy go up and down. I was noticing, I'm hungry. I want something to eat. So I noticed hunger. That was really disturbing as a young man. So, I noticed that the Buddha never said to watch the nose or the belly. He said, watch the breath. So, I just asked myself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Which one is it? I'm breathing in. I know that. How I know that, it's not necessary to really consider. But I know it's going in, I know it's going out. That's enough. Now, the problem is, if you do watch the tip of the nose, when I was teaching in Malaysia, the first time I went to Kuala Lumpur, people were complaining about meditation headache. I'd never heard that before. Do you hear meditation headache in Sri Lanka? Well, what's going on? Meditation is relaxed, it's overcoming headaches. And it took me a while to figure out what on earth was going on. And to describe what's going on, I'm going to take off my glasses. So those in the front, and maybe the TV, can actually focus on my eyes. Now usually you meditate with your eyelids closed. But if you meditate with your eyelids open, and you watch the tip of the nose, this is what you do. Because where your mind watches, that's where your eyes automatically watch as well. So all these meditators watching the tip of the nose were going cross-eyed. You do that for about 10 or 15 minutes, yes, you'll get a tension headache across here. So, that's not how you meditate. You relax. Watch the breath go in, the breath go out. Nothing to do in the whole world. No past to worry about. No future to be concerned about. Getting away from it all. Club Med temple trees. Watching breath go in, breath go out. Oh, this is so nice. That's how meditation happens. Delightful. That's what got me into being a monk. I like a good time. Still keeping all your precepts. Sitting here, if I want a good time, just close my eyes, meditate. Oh, this is really good. The joy, the happiness of relaxation, peace. Body really relax. The mind enjoying just watching the breath. That's just the start. As Ronald Reagan used to say, President Reagan, you ain't seen anything yet. Because that's just the start. Because the meditation, if you don't force it, you let go naturally by itself. It just goes in and becomes more and more peaceful, more and more still. Because you're not breathing very much, because you're not active, you're not thinking, you're not worrying, you're not in the past or the future, your body's really still and relaxed and comfortable, you're not using much fuel in your car. It's a wonderful thing today because apparently there's a petrol shortage, but there's an energy shortage as well in your poor overused brain. Imagine, your brain is hardly using any energy at all. Just in this moment, still, peaceful, not worrying about anything in the whole world, just watching the breath go in. Of course, your metabolic rate goes down. You don't need so much oxygen. So you breathe in less and less. More and more peaceful. More and more joy. More and more happiness comes into the meditation. That is how the Buddha taught. Fifth, sixth stage of Anapanasati, experiencing piti and sukha, joy, in the meditation. Once you know how to do that, oh, meditation's fun. It's joyful. You just love doing it. That's why my meditation retreats, which I teach in Australia, it's almost impossible to get in them. As soon as they open up for booking, usually 1 minute or 2 minutes, and it's all full. Why?
because people love it. They enjoy it so much. And that joy, that happiness goes deeper relaxation. Happy to be here. They don't want to think about anything or do anything. And the joy, the peace gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then the joy is much stronger than the breath. You see these beautiful lights in the mind. The nimittas. The sign of your jitta, your mind. Beautiful lights. Like the moon on a poya night. Clear sky, a beautiful radiant moon. That is an important part of the meditation. That means the body is relaxed and disappeared. And the sixth sense of mind is coming up. It's not hard to do. It's natural. It's just what happens when you get out of the way and stop interfering. It's a natural process. When you let go, when you don't drive the car, it stops. Now many people experience those lights in their meditation. They're not dangerous. In fact, it's dangerous not to meditate. When they come up, just relax, enjoy, and see what happens next. And of course, what happens next is they get brighter and more brilliant. And your body is perfectly safe. So safe. I have all these wonderful tales of what happens when a person goes into the next stage, goes into these incredible bliss states where the body you cannot feel, you cannot hear, you cannot see, you cannot smell, taste, or have any physical touch, but you're perfectly aware. The jhanas. One of my friends, his name was Greg. I can say that now because it's a long time ago. Long enough I can maintain his anonymity. On a Sunday afternoon in Perth, he was meditating. There's nothing on TV. He told his wife, I'm going into the bedroom to meditate. Usually half an hour, 40 minutes is max. After 1 hour, he had not come out of his room. So his wife went to check on him. And there he was in his meditation position, sitting perfectly still, meditating. Perfectly still. Too still. He couldn't even see him breathing. And the wife was so afraid. She called the emergency number. What's the emergency number in Colombo? 999 or is it 111 or 000? It's very difficult. If I had an emergency, I wouldn't know which one to call. They should standardize them throughout the whole world. But anyway, they called the emergency number, and the ambulance came within 5 minutes, a Sunday afternoon, it wasn't busy. And the medics, they ran into the bedroom, felt his, there's no pulse. No pulse. So straight into the stretcher, in the back of the ambulance, going through all the red lights, it's an emergency. He had no vital signs. Straight into the emergency room. Triage nurse had a look at him. Really important, put an ECG on first of all. Flat line. An EEG. Another flat line. He was dead. So that was the first thought. But he was so fortunate that afternoon. If that had been an Australian doctor, he'd been sent right down to the morgue. Which meant, well, when he came out of his meditation, there'd be two morgue attendants dead. Imagine that, you're working in the morgue and you think someone's dead and they suddenly wake up. He wasn't dead, he was just meditating. So the doctor was from India. And the doctor had heard that in these deep meditations, you can actually suspend all your vital signs, all your life activities. And he heard from his wife that he'd been meditating. And the other interesting phenomena, which you will see in the Chulavetala Sutta, the difference between a dead body and one meditating is they're still warm. His body was still warm. It was not getting colder at all. So he decided to try defibrillators. You might have seen that on the TV, they put these defibrillators, bang! There's an electric shock, bang! Goes up from the... It's really important, if ever you have to give a public talk, don't just sit there and go, bruh, 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 and send people to sleep. Make it active, put some energy into public speaking. And then people actually come alive. So, boom! That's the electric defibrillators. Arch his body and raise the body. So many times, he didn't actually tell me exactly how long they were doing this defibrillating, but nothing happened. Still flatlining. Until he told me he decided to come out of his meditation. And he opened his eyes. Beep, beep, beep. The ECG, EEG monitors were normal. And he leant up. What am I doing in here? I was in my bedroom. What happened? He hadn't heard the sound of the sirens. Hadn't been able to feel his body being put in the back of an ambulance. Hadn't even been able to feel the electric shocks going through his body. But he was perfectly aware all the time. Strong mindfulness. But just inside that sixth sense of mind. And doctor gave him thorough examination. Perfectly healthy. He was so healthy the doctor said, go home. And he walked home with his wife. And he told me afterwards the only negative part of that experience, he said, was his wife scolded him all the way home. Don't you ever do that again. But it was perfectly safe, you're happy, and it has huge health benefits and also huge insight benefits, which we'll come across later on. That is possible in today. The jhanas you read about in the suttas, in the time of the Buddha, people do that today. It's possible. And the resulting magapala is also possible in today's world. It happens. Not just monks, upasakas, upasikas as well. The Dharma is still strong. Meditation still leaves these amazing effects. So, I can go on for a long time, but people are always looking at me and saying, it's about time. I was quiet, and we actually did some meditation. Actions speak louder than words. Or as that little cartoon said, the two monks, and one monk said to the other, are you not thinking what I'm not thinking? So let's stop thinking, let's actually do some meditation. Now, I don't know if it's possible, but I think maybe not be possible. Sometimes, you know, are you okay to meditate just sitting down where you are for 15, 20 minutes? You know, if you want to sort of stretch your legs out or wiggle your bottom or something to fit it a bit, that's fine. Because, you know, it's pretty packed in this room, so you can't really get up and stretch. So what I'll do a guided meditation for 15 minutes. Is that okay, 15? And then we'll do a little Q&A afterwards. 20. Is that okay? We've got enough time for questions afterwards? Okay, 20 minutes. Here we go. Well, 20 minutes is not enough time to get into jhana, so you're not going to go to the hospital this afternoon. So you relax. So close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, bring awareness to your posture. How are you sitting now? Feel the body. Do you need to push your feet further away from the chair or tuck them in? Move your legs apart or close them up? When you move your legs, you're getting feedback. Which position is the best for you this afternoon? You'll find that day to day, even within a day, the body needs different postures. Changes. So I'm looking at my body, making sure my robes are just nice. My legs, yeah, they're pretty good. And then even your bottom. Have you ever noticed how people fidget? Because we don't really give much attention to our bottom, our buttocks, sitting on a chair. So fidget them until you get the best possible position for them. Every time you move, you get a different experience. Mindfulness gives you feedback. And kindness gets the best position for your buttocks. And once they've been looked at and are comfortable, then you're back. Sometimes you need to slump. Sometimes you need to be straight. Sometimes you need to lean back against the backrest of the chair. Try all of those until you find what you feel is the most comfortable. Physiotherapists say the best position for your back is to lean back on the backrest, 15 degrees from the vertical, which is why the chairs are made like that. So if you want to lean back, fine. If you want to be straight, fine. You discover the optimum, the best position for you. And I like just moving my back, fidgeting around to try and get the most comfortable position. Have you ever seen a dog or a cat curling up in a bed? They move this way and that way until they get really comfortable. The cats and dogs know about posture. Once you've prepared your body, got your back, okay. Now your arms and your hands. You find so many books saying, oh, you put your hands this way in this mudra or that mudra. Look, feel it yourself. Your hands right now, what is the most comfortable position for them? A position which you can maintain for another 17 minutes. And once you've got your hands in the correct position, now your shoulders. Shoulders are a great seat of tension. So, imagine your shoulders, all these tendons, these muscles, like a bundle of strings or straws, a whole bundle of them, being stretched at both ends. On the left shoulder muscles, the right shoulder muscles, they're stretched. And now you imagine letting those strings go. So they're loose. Every strand of muscles relaxes. Your mindfulness, knowing the feelings in your shoulders, can find how to relax. Letting go, kindness, opening the door of your heart to those feelings in the muscles. Like a mother kissing a wound better. It relaxes. And it's kind and beautiful. You're relaxing your body. And then go up to your neck. I have a little irritation in my neck. Just a bit of allergy to something or other. It's really just unfortunate being a senior monk, having allergies, because I always have to sit closest to the flowers. Never mind. I relax my throat. Feel the irritation and relax it. Giving this beautiful, soft attention to an irritation. The mindfulness gives me feedback. Until I can relax the irritation till it disappears. If you do need to cough, please cough so we avoid the volcano effect. And then, once I've relaxed my throat, I move up to my face. People have lots of tension around the eyes and the mouth and the forehead. It's a sign of emotional tension played out on the face. So I now become aware of the feelings in the muscles around my eyes. Once I'm mindful of those sensations, I relax them. Try this, try that, until you learn. From the feedback which mindfulness gives you, you learn how to relax muscles.
The disc that will, you can relax anything. So now I'm relaxing the muscles around my eyes and the rest of my face. When I know how to relax those muscles, I will never need to use Botox. I can relax them at will. And once my facial muscles are relaxed, I look at my whole body sitting here as a unit, relaxed, at peace. And next I like to go to a part of the body which may still be irritated, maybe inside your body. If you've still got an ache or pain somewhere, focus on it, zoom in on it, and give it kindness, like some monster who's come into your body. Welcome irritation. Welcome ache, welcome pain. Thank you for being here. And see if through kindness, the irritation can get less and less and less. This is a short period, so maybe you can't get the delightful body. But it feels so relaxed, so at ease, so nice. As soon as I can feel the delight of a relaxed body, my body goes to another level of relaxation. I look at my body, it's not a tight piece of body anywhere. And once I've attended to my body and built up the ability to be aware, to be mindful and to be kind, I now look at my peaceometer. Right now, how peaceful are you, or how agitated? A number from 1 to 10, please. So now you're looking at the peaceometer. What attitude of mind is needed to move that needle closer and closer to peace? What moves that needle to more disturbance? So you learn how to relax your own mind. Learn how to be peaceful. You'll find it is letting go of the past and future with kindness. Just being here, not wanting anything in the world, just to be here. Developing peaceful mind. Your mind is also like a rubber band pulled to the past, stretched into the future. That's why your mind feels tense. It's stretched. So you let go of the past, you let go of the future, so nothing is pulling your mind. Nothing is pushing it, squashing it, stretching it. You're letting go. You're just here, in this moment, with kindness. Just like a Buddha smiling on you. You don't have to achieve anything. You are loved as you are. Don't have to please anybody. Your mind can relax. As Ajahn Chah would always remind me, we meditate to let go, not to attain. To be peaceful. To be kind. And once you are peaceful enough, once you are calm, the breath will come up by itself. in the silence, in the relaxed state, you start to be aware of your breath coming in and your breath going out. You're not worrying about or concerned about where you notice the breath. You just know the breath is coming in. You know the breath has finished coming in and now it's going out. Natural, kind, aware, making sure the piezometer is still going down closer to one. Making peace with your breathing. Just in this moment, no past, no future, just the breath happening now. If you find you have an active mind still, then as you breathe in, you can say to yourself, breathing in peace. If you're sick, breathing in health. Breathing in peace, health. And as you breathe out, let go. Let go of any problems, any health issues, any tiredness. Breathing in peace, health, light. Breathing out, let go. And imagine what peace, what health is to you. And as you let go, imagine it may be some sickness. It may be some tension. Imagine it. In whatever way you can visualize it, going out with every out-breath. Breathing in peace. Breathing out, let go. If you need to cough, please just cough. Don't become tight and controlled. Relax, let go. Like your body is opening out, your mind is opening to free, no pressure, no pull, no push. Breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. See if you can notice how delightful it is just to be in this moment. It's like being on holiday, away from all the busyness of your life. Just breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. But try not to judge yourself. This is good enough. We only watch one breath at a time. And let the body do the breathing. Don't control the breath. If the breath wants to go in short, long, rough, smooth, that's the body's job. Your job is just to watch. To be a passenger, not a driver. Breathing in peace. Breathing out, let go. Not a care in the world. You deserve peace. Freedom from time. Just here in this moment. Breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. Relaxing the mind, letting go,
No one is going to assess you, judge you. Don't judge yourself. Just be in this moment. Being in that piezometer needle closer and closer to one. How does that feel now? What's it like? Your mind, your body. How delightful and liberating it is to be peaceful. It's getting very close to the end of this short period of meditation. So see if you could count the next three breaths, in, out, in, out, in, out. At the end of the third breath, open your eyes to end the meditation after the next three breaths. And then please smile. Whoever's teaching you meditation has to look at all of you. It makes me feel happy when you smile at the end of a meditation. Thank you. Okay. There we go. So now we have time for some questions. Hopefully just on meditation. So first of all, how did that go? Was that okay? Was that easy? Did anybody go into jhanas and get taken off to hospital? No.
Sounds so simple, but it's very difficult to do.
Sounds so simple because it is simple. It's a default state. It's what happens when you don't do anything. Meditating. People always want to do meditating. Meditating is the opposite of doing something. It's stopping. Letting go. There's an old simile of meditation. Actually, not an old simile, a new one, because I invented it. The donkey and the carrot. Do they still have donkey carts in Sri Lanka?
No.
Okay. Actually, I saw one a long time ago. They have it in India. They used to have them in Europe. So have donkey and the cart. The trouble... Okay.
Very good.
Okay. Donkey and the carrot. If you get a stick and you beat the donkey will not pull the cart. Instead, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. At the end of the stick, you put a string. At the end of the string, you put carrot. Donkey likes carrots. So maybe if it was a Sri Lankan donkey, you may have to put a mango or a hopper or something there. Depends on the time of the day. So there, the donkey sees a nice juicy mango. And donkey likes the mango. So what does the donkey do? It goes towards the carrot. Let's use the carrot. Goes towards the carrot. And when the donkey moves towards the carrot, so does the stick, so does the string, so does the carrot. So it doesn't matter how fast that donkey goes, the carrot is always 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. That's how some people meditate. Always chasing, chasing, chasing. They never get peaceful.
But then one day, the donkey comes to Club Med Temple Trees and learns how to catch carrots. It's so easy when you figure it out. Meditation is simple when you get the message. So what does the donkey do? It just stops. Been running after the carrot all day, now it just stops. What does the carrot do? Because of momentum, the carrot swings further away from the donkey. The donkey doesn't get upset, it just stops, it's patient. Goes further away until the carrot is 4 foot in front of the donkey's face. Never been that far away before. But then something strange happens. Goes swings all the way up, 4 foot away, and then starts swinging back again. Soon it's a normal place, 2 foot in the front of the donkey's mouth, coming at great speed towards its mouth. It stops, it swings up, back, and the last thing the donkey always must remember after stopping is compassion. As the carrot comes close to the donkey's mouth, the donkey says, "Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you." And that's how they catch a carrot. If you just stop, your mind becomes peaceful. Remember Angulimala? Stop! Monk, said Angulimala to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "I have stopped, you stop." Angulimala stopped. Not physically, well physically, but also mentally. Stopped, and the carrot comes towards Angulimala.
I think that's a good point for the first question I have got here.
Yeah, go on.
Is the question of, now you were always saying, let go and let it be and all that. And where does effort, virya comes? You're supposed to, you know, atapi and all this.
The effort to restrain. The effort to abandon. The effort to develop good things. You strive and you just get stuffed up in your head. You get tense, you get sick. The right effort, which is coming from the samasankappa, the right, I call it right motivation. Sometimes people call it right thought. The second factor of the Eightfold Path. And that is renunciation. Nekama sankappa. Avayapada. No ill will. A synonym for metta, and ahimsaka sankappa, which we all know from Mahatma Gandhi, gentleness, non-violence. That's the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which actually is where the effort is coming from. The effort of renouncing, letting go, giving up. Stop judging yourself, stop striving. Be kind. It's wonderful kindness, compassion of a Buddha. The Buddha strove, or rather the Bodhisattva strove for 6 years, got nowhere. Stop striving, was kind, renounced, let go, was gentle under the Bodhi tree. His first 5 disciples thought he'd given up. How can you ever get enlightened when you're not striving like you used to? They abandoned him. But when they saw the Buddha after his enlightenment, they realized this teacher was onto something. And he taught the middle way. Letting go, renouncing, giving up. The 4 ways of letting go, Second Noble Truth. What are those 4 ways? Remember, it's chaga. Giving up, giving away, not getting things. Striving is what you get things. Giving away, chaga pati nisaga, which is another word for renouncing. Muti, freeing. Anarya, not letting anything stick. The Teflon mind, or what I usually use these days, is a lotus. A lotus flower, nothing sticks to it. If someone urinates on a lotus, the stinky, smelly urine just all falls off, and afterwards the lotus still has its very sweet, fragrant smell. Or someone pours Chanel No. 5 over the lotus. That doesn't stick. All flows off, and it still smells like a lotus. Praise and blame, nothing sticks. Gain and loss, know, fame and infamy, all those loka dhammas, they don't stick to you. That's a lotus. It's called letting go, renouncing, not accumulating. So it's a letting go form of effort, a stopping. It takes effort to put on the brake. It takes effort to let go. It takes effort to give up things.
I think the next question is linked to that, interestingly, that I sometimes practice, I try to meditate after a hard day's work, and very soon I realize I have fallen asleep. What's the difference between meditating and falling asleep?
Falling asleep is the start of meditating. For those of you very tired. When I became a monk, it was in the jungles of northeast Thailand. I was malnourished. One meal a day, sticky rice. I was a vegetarian before I was a monk. Sometimes sticky rice and a frog on top. That's all we had to eat. Yeah, a frog, boiled frog. No garlic, no salt, no, just a bowl of glutinous sticky rice with a frog on top. That was all the villagers had. In fact, they gave us the best frogs. It was disgusting. But I was malnourished. And in the morning we would get up, we were only supposed to sleep 4 hours a night. I could never get below 4.5. So, 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd be up in the hall to meditate. Steamy jungles. I was made in England. I was not used to such hot weather, such sticky weather. Malnourished, not enough sleep. Of course I was sleepy. So I had the tricks. What we tried to do, first of all, you know, use effort. Didn't work. So then I tried a matchbox. You take the cover off the matchbox, you put the tray on your head. Because it means if you start nodding, you'd see the matchbox fall on the ground. You'd hear it. Only about 3 or 4 days, I'd overcome my sloth and torpor. I could put the matchbox on my head, for 1 hour meditate in the morning, it never fell off at all. Amazing, until one of my monks took me aside and said, this is why the matchbox is not falling off. You're still sleepy, but instead of doing this, you're doing this. The mind is so sneaky and tricky. So after a while, I started contemplating, look, made in England. I'm not used to that climate. I'm not enough sleep. Not enough food. It's natural. So I decided to let go. When I let go, there was not much energy in my mind. So you were dull, but you knew you were dull. And little by little, just like when the sun comes up in the morning and it evaporates all the mist, it burns off the mist. Because I wasn't wasting energy, fighting my sleepiness, but just letting it be, being kind to it, opening the door of my heartness, my energy started coming back again. My back straightened up, my head lifted up naturally, and I was peaceful. You fight sleepiness, you prolong it. The reason why you are sleepy is because you are tired. It's natural. Many of you don't know how to sleep at night. So, happens so often in meditation retreats. As I said, when people start meditating, they fall asleep. And when they go to bed at night, they complain they can't go to sleep. So, the solution is obvious. I say, well, when you're in the meditation hall, please try to go to sleep. When you go to bed at night, try to meditate. That means they solve the problem. They're trying instead of letting go. So it's good. You fall asleep when you're meditating. Well done. The problem is with people who think too much when they're meditating. Restless mind. They're the problems. So allow yourself to fall asleep. The sleepiness will soon disappear, and then you'll wake up and be nice and peaceful, and you can go deeper there.
Now that you mentioned sloth and torpor and restlessness both, how do we recognize the five hindrances, and what should we be doing when we know that those are present?
When you know those are present, you just remember just to follow the Eightfold Path. Follow the Four Noble Truths. Two types of meditation. Second Noble Truth meditation and Third Noble Truth meditation. What Second Noble Truth? Wanting is the cause of suffering. So if you want to get rid of your sloth and torpor, you want to get rid of this, you want to get rid of that, you want this, you want that, you're asking for dukkha. That's what the Buddha said. Craving leads to dukkha. So what is Third Noble Truth meditation?
Letting go. Renouncing. Stop worrying whether you're asleep or whether you're restless. Oh, let it go. That is the path to nirvana. It works. You do your letting go, renouncing, giving up, second factor of the Eightfold Path.
Instead of calling it renouncing, because people think that means becoming a monk or a nun, many times I say, make peace with your sloth and torpor, with your restlessness. Be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's almost like one of the phrases, you know, which people recognize me by, the make peace, be kind, be gentle monk. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. You do that, and you're restless, you've got sort of tiredness, they soon vanish. You're putting what I call meditation karma. There's good meditation karma, which gets the good results, peace, happiness, liberation, jhanas. Or you have karma, bad meditation karma, which leads to more problems. Karma is all about intention. Right intention is second factor of Eightfold Path. So if you're meditating, making peace, being kind, being gentle, or renouncing, being kind, being gentle, you're making, as the Buddha said, good meditation karma. It's going to have some good results. And it does. You get peaceful. You can watch your breathing. It gets delightful. You get nimittas, you get jhanas, you get the whole works. Because you made the good karma. You cannot expect to get peace by fighting your body. You can't get peace by making war.
There was another interesting question which came from that. I get two types of questions. Some are related to meditation, but some are general questions. I'll try to bring the two. And sometimes we tend to talk of all this high-flown stuff, but forgetting the precepts. And in Sri Lanka, we are quite conversant and we talk a lot about all the advanced aspect of Buddhism. But when it comes to precepts, we think, especially the fifth precepts, we can be middle path on that and that kind of thing. What's your view on this one thing?
This is how I discovered the Pansil. I meditated first. I was a young man. I had girlfriends. I got drunk several times. I was supposed to be a refined university like Cambridge. There was bacchanalia, celebrating the most refined drinks. Port, claret, Madeira, really expensive from the cottage cellars. On one occasion, the scholars' dinner, having drunk so much alcohol already, we had to do a toast with this goblet, silver goblet encrusted with jewels, a college heirloom, that was Emmanuel College in Cambridge, and we had to, that was filled with claret, if I can remember properly, to the brim. We had to drain it, drink the whole lot, and then say a toast in Latin. This was supposed to be an intelligent university. I decided this didn't make any sense to me. And the following morning, I don't know how I got back to my room, but I woke up in the morning with a pile of vomit on my pillow right next to me.
I didn't realize that that could have killed me. People choke on that and die. And I felt terrible for the next 24 hours. And everyone was saying what a wonderful evening that was. That was the last time I took any alcohol in my life. It made no sense at all to me. If I went on a bus in London, if the conductor never asked for the fare, why should I give it to him? It's his fault. But I couldn't do that anymore. When you're mindful, and you become aware, and you're kind, it doesn't make any sense. So, when it got down, I was a vegetarian at the time. When it got time, I was going to the temple, and one of the priests took me aside. You've been coming here long enough, it's about time you took the pansil. And this was accurate, this had happened. It was in a Thai temple, but I used the Sri Lankan words. I said, "Venerable sir, what is the pansil?" You know, not killing any of anything, I'm a vegetarian. Not sort of stealing. Even if the conductor doesn't ask for my fare, I always give it to him. So, you know, he brought my fare, here it is. Not committing adultery. Ooh, one girlfriend was expensive enough. Not lying. It never felt right to tell a lie to anybody. And not taking alcohol. I said I've been giving up alcohol a long time already. And you may say I was conceited, but it was a good anecdote. I said, "Venerable sir, I don't need to take the 5 precepts. I've been keeping them for the last couple of years." Without knowing that they were precepts. So a wise person, a mindful person, someone who meditates, discovers the purpose for the precepts. They're basic common sense. I thought when I gave up alcohol, I would not get invited to so many parties. I was a young man, you know, 19 or something, just enjoying my life, going out to parties, dances, girlfriends. To my surprise, I got invited to even more parties. Because my friends wanted someone sober to drive them home. That was me. There's many advantages. But if you find the reason, the wisdom, why you keep the 5 precepts, it becomes so obvious, it's easy to keep. But I always thought 5 precepts, 8 precepts, but in Singapore, in some temples they keep 13 precepts. I've never ever heard of the 13 precepts before, until it was explained to me. On the Poya days, you keep 8 precepts in the morning, and 5 precepts in the afternoon.
After drill.
Afternoon, yeah. So you still eat your dinner. The 8 precepts is only up till noon. That doesn't make any sense at all. But also in Thailand, I saw this. People were taking their pansil. You know, you usually put your hands up. And they did this. They had one finger down. I'd never seen that before. And so I asked, "What's going on? Why'd you put one finger down?" He said, "Oh, because they're only keeping 4 precepts today." They still charted the whole 5. And then you look more carefully, and sure enough, you saw someone with 2 fingers down. And even after a few weeks, I saw one. They still charted everything, but they weren't keeping it. That was in Thailand.
The point you're trying to stress was it's not two separate things.
Not two separate things, it's wisdom. You don't do that, you know, to try and, you know, make good karma points. It's common sense to keep precepts. Wise people are good people. Trustworthy people. Look, now this is tough, please don't get offended, but not even a dog would drink alcohol. If you have a dog, even a really thirsty wild dog, you put a bowl of alcohol in front of it, would it drink it? People do. So who's wise and who's stupid? Now that's a tough one, but, you know, how high are you? Okay.
Okay. I think you said it loud and clear.
Yes.
Bhante, we get so many teachings in different ways with the exploration of internet and media and various instructions. How do we know that we are following the right advice, and how is my practice moving? Because Buddha says, compare it with Dhamma and Vinaya, but we don't know all that to do that. So how do we steer the path?
The Buddha gave this wonderful advice to Upali, also to Mahaprajapati, the first bhikkhuni. So you know it's the Dhamma, it's the teaching of the Buddha. If it leads to letting go, not to attaining more things, but renouncing, letting go of things, to peace, freedom, and obviously things like things ceasing, viraga, nirodha, sambodhi, enlightenment, nibbana. If it leads to the right things, you know you're going in the right path. A simile, because it's nice to have similes. When I was a student, I used to spend a lot of vacations up in the highlands of Scotland. I would take a tent and go in solitude for a few days. I was maybe a natural monk. So on one occasion I was staying at a youth hostel in the far north of Scotland, in the mountains. And the warden of the youth hostel said, beautiful day today, let's go for a walk up on top of the mountain. So we went together, about 3 or 4 hours. We got to the top, again a wonderful sunny day in Scotland. There was another mountain, let's go into the top of that mountain as well. And the warden said, no, you go by yourself. He was a local man, he should not have allowed me to go by myself. In the wilderness, you don't go alone. Because this is what happened. As I got to the summit of the second mountain, the clouds came in from the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. And they came in so fast. It was a clear sunny day 1 minute, 10 minutes later the clouds had come down and I was enveloped in the mist. I couldn't even see the hand in front of me. I thought I had a sense of direction, so I turned around and decided to walk down the mountain again. And I came literally within one step, that distance, there was a vertical cliff. If I hadn't been mindful, I wouldn't be here. That really scared me. This was dangerous. I could not see where I was going. I was lost, with no sense of direction. So I stood and thought, considered a solution to the problem. Basic science. Find a stream, even a little brook, because water always flows downhill. So I found a little brook, followed it. Another little rivulet came into it, got bigger and bigger, and I followed it down and down. Whichever way it meandered, I'd follow it religiously, until it got so low down, I was underneath the mist, and I could see my directions. And that's how I got back a long time later to the youth hostel. And this is a simile which I give to people these days. Before you are a so-one, a stream winner, you are in the mist. You don't know which way to go. One teacher says do this, another teacher says do something else. What should you do? Find a stream which goes in the correct direction, which makes you more peaceful, more kind, more aware, less attachments. Those are the signs you're going in the right direction. You keep going on that path. If you don't realize that, the people you live with realize that. Ask your wife. After you meditate, are you an easier person to live with? Are you a kinder person? A wiser person? Ask your husband. Ask your kids. Kids are very honest. Mummy, go to meditation. Why, darling? You're a much nicer mummy when you come back. Eventually, you keep being more peaceful, more still, more kind, more ethical, until you follow the stream of Dhamma and going in the right direction, until you get underneath the mist. You can see the direction. That's stream winning. Now you know which way to go. It's obvious. The doubt is overcome.
Okay, from there shall we get to some simple questions as well?
Yeah.
And this is a question that we discussed yesterday morning also. The how to make decisions.
Decisions. I was in Oslo University. Question came, really important decision to make in my life. How do I make it? Really important, this young woman. I shouldn't have done this, because I said, well, let's make it more concrete. Suppose you were considering marrying the boy sitting next to you. And this poor woman, she put her hands in front of her head. She went beetle red, because that's exactly the decision she was contemplating. I shouldn't have done that. So I said, so easy. So you've got your boy next to you. You're not sure. It's a big decision in life. You're going to marry him or you're not going to marry him. Accept the proposal or not. So simple. Get out a coin. Heads, I marry him. Tails, I don't. But that's not the end of it. You toss up the coin. Heads, I marry him. Tails, I don't. It comes up heads. What's your reaction? If you think, yes, that means you really wanted to marry him all along. If it comes up heads and think, let's try 2 out of 3. Then that means you don't want to marry him. So tossing up the coin is not making a decision for you. It's how you react to the result indicates what you really want to do. Your intuition, your inner feeling. And that's what you should follow.
Talking about inner feeling, and you were, that's the question I should have asked earlier. The question about deep meditation and things like that. Sometimes people say, if you don't meditate under a good meditation teacher, you can go off your head. And are there people who should not be meditating, or is there a way to
handle this? More people go off their head by not meditating. So yeah, there's some people, because they get wrong teachings, misunderstand them, have trouble, but it's usually pretty easy to fix. And I always thought the one person, group of people who should never meditate were those who suffer from schizophrenia. Because I thought that their delusions would be amplified. Until I got one of my monks who's a clinical schizophrenic, and he's brilliant. He proved me wrong. Clinical schizophrenic. He's on clozapine, I think. A wonderful monk. Meditates. So kind. Keeps his good veneer. He's beginning to teach a bit now. He proved me wrong. You have to tailor meditation to different people. It's not one size fits all. But everybody can get benefit from meditation. Serial killer Angulimala, no problem. Chula Pantaka, just intellectually a bit disabled, no problem. Pathachara, just distraught, crazy, traumatized by the loss of her husband, her 2 children, and her 2 parents on the same day. You think that's post-traumatic stress. Fully enlightened and one of the best teachers ever. They can do it, but just have to have teachings which are tailored to them.
Talking about different people reaching enlightenment, and there was a question on email saying, should somebody be a Buddhist to meditate, and should be a Buddhist to reach enlightenment?
Should you be a scientist to do experiments? If you do experiments, you are a scientist. So that's what a scientist is. People who live in a lab and experiment. Well, it's a Buddhist. People keep 5 precepts and practice 8-fold path and meditate. So whether you say you're a Buddhist or not, you are. So get used to it. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So you are a Buddhist. Things are so complicated these days.
People are transgendered. You don't know whether to go to the male or female toilets. But you know, if you meditate, you're a Buddhist. Be a Buddhist. What's wrong with that? It's just, this is, you don't always have to be a Buddhist. You can change later on if you like, if you feel that it's not the right path for you. If you're a scientist, you know, you call yourself a scientist, but if you want to retire and just, you know, be an artist, then you're an artist. But if you know, if you're painting things on a canvas, you're an artist. So call yourself, you know, by your true name.
Okay. there's another interesting question here that I will put it into a bigger context so that we can have a better discussion on this. Even on meditation, you try, you fail. In life, you try, you fail. How do you deal with failure?
A failure is wonderful. If you fail, please share your mistake. About 2 years ago, I was called into the local hospital in Perth, the ICU. There was an elderly Chinese gentleman who was in a coma, was dying. And his relations asked me to come and do some chanting, some gathas for him. I've got a powerful mind. My chanting, when I'm on form, just like, you know, the top batsman in Sri Lanka, you can hit centuries. I was really sort of on form that day. I gave some really strong gathas. The gentleman recovered, like a miracle. He came out of his coma. He recovered. That is when I got into big trouble. Because the family is a Chinese family. They come from Singapore, from Hong Kong, from Taiwan. They come for the last moments of their father. They even arranged a funeral service. And I come along, and he recovered. They were so upset. So we wasted our time. We've got to go home again now. We've got to count that we lost a lot of money. We've got to come back later on, maybe 6 months or a year, when he dies properly. We never wanted him to get better. We wanted you to chant for a peaceful death. I got into big trouble there, but I learned from my mistakes. So now whenever I go to do some gathas and chant for someone, I ask, what chanting do you want? The die peaceful chant or the get better chant? You've got to let me know first of all. Not my... So when you make mistakes, you learn and you share, because it's how we learn from mistakes, and we enjoy that people's mistakes are what makes life, gives it character, it's enjoyable, it's fun.
In Buddhism, we speak of measuring ourselves is not very good, and we talk of these three levels of measuring, comparing equal, superior, inferior. And on the other hand, in the world of today, we say you got to assert yourself and be assertive. How do you manage this?
Oh, come on. If you assert yourself, you just upset people. In our world, we have to cooperate with others. Whether it's in a cricket team, whether it's in a cabinet, in a monastery, in the Ajahn Brahm Society in Colombo, we have to learn how to work together as a team. So asserting yourself is the competitive edge. But we don't encourage enough the cooperative edge. Which is one of the reasons which I've been saying for a long time now, to improve our education systems. I really hated it when I was doing an examination and I was competing against my best friend. That was really horrible. I loved my best friend. I wanted to share with him, but I was competing with him. So I decided after that, wouldn't it be wonderful, say in a class, 30 children, maybe 70% of your score at the end of the year was personal, what you did in your exam. The other 30% was averaged over the class to which you belonged. So in other words, if there was a weak person in your class, it was in your interest to help them, to work as a team. Because otherwise, all we ever learn in school, in our education system,
is how to beat our friends instead of how to work with them. If we don't reward cooperation, it's never developed. That's one of the reasons why there's office politics. We don't know how to cooperate. We've never learned that. We know how to compete. Why husbands and wives argue. We never learn how to cooperate. So we're competing again. So, it's social engineering, correct. But it's so positive. In real life, in the office, at home, wherever you are, we have to cooperate as well as compete as well. Unfortunately, our world is far too competitive. Not enough cooperation.
Do you think that as a possible reason for the increasing teen suicides in most societies? And what would you be advised to parents how to deal with children?
First of all, don't let your children be afraid of you. They are. This Sri Lankan girl in Perth, you know, she'd been coming to the temple since she was 1 or 2 years of age, playing, making a racket and a noise, as kids do. That's why, you know, please bring your kids to the temples, let them get familiar with the monks, sometimes playing with them. But, means when she got to 16 or 17, she came to see me, said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm in trouble. I said, what's the trouble? I'm pregnant with my boyfriend. And I said, have you told your mum and dad yet? He said, no, that's why I've come to you. Can you please tell them for me? I said, why don't you tell them? They'll kill me. And she was scared of her parents. She thought she'd be punished, so she wanted me to be the intermediary. So I went to the parents. Look, kids make mistakes. She's a good girl, but she's got herself into trouble. Don't know why. Could be peer pressure. You know, she lost her mindfulness because she liked her boyfriend. One thing led to another, and then now she's pregnant. She doesn't need to be afraid of you. She needs your help and support. Children make mistakes. But that really opened up, why is it your children will not come and see you when they're in really big trouble? Small trouble, they'll come and see you, but big trouble, they're afraid of you. They're afraid of being scolded, shouted at, even beaten, because you're ashamed of them. Please tell your kids, you can come and tell me anything, son, daughter, anything. I may be disappointed, but I'm here to help you. That's my job as a mum, as a dad, to look after you when you're in difficulty. Yeah, you want to discipline them, tell them what's right from what's wrong, but sometimes we go too far, which means our children hide things from us. And when they really need to tell you something, they're scared. So that's one of the reasons. Have this wonderful rule of amnesty, like Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Tell your children, son, daughter, you can tell me anything. Even terrible, terrible things. You've been in trouble with drugs. You've been taking drugs. If you tell me the truth, son, I won't punish you. Because I'm here to help you. You need your dad, your mum, to help you terrible, terrible time. That's what we're here for. We make mistakes. So I don't want to scare you away. If you can do that, as long as your children tell you the truth, no punishment. No scolding, no shouting. Because you need to help them.
Another question. This is a bit of a Zen type question. You're sometimes told, die with your action. You just do something, don't think about it. On the other hand, we have a habit or tradition which says all the good things you have done in your life, you're supposed to write in a book, and then before you die, you can read them, you can remember. So the question is, if you have done something bad, obviously you say don't think about it.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you have done something really good, which was really nice, Should you be keep thinking about it, or are you done and just let go?
Well, it depends which option you want. Certainly it's a stupid option to keep thinking of all the bad things you've done. So the next option, like the Toyota option, is actually just to think of the good things. The Rolls-Royce option is not to think of anything. If you can do that, that's the best. Be peaceful, be still. But if you can't do that, at least think of good stuff.
So you suggest you keep thinking your good things, or you...
It's better to think of good things than bad things. It's best to be still and peaceful, to let go. That's the very, very, very best.
That links to the question of habits and addictions. We discussed, I know, tomorrow, yesterday morning this, but getting into habits of technology, pornography, and all these things of today, and some practical tips how people can get out of these addictions. This is a serious problem, I think.
Yeah, it's a serious topic. Now, sometimes people do go to, say, meditation retreats. And our meditation retreat over in Perth is in a very, very difficult place to get a signal. We chose it there. Even though the people can walk a little bit away, they found out the hot spots where they can get a signal. But sometimes it's great to when you go on to a temple for a retreat, to hand in your mobile phones. Hand in everything. You can give the number of the temple in case there's any emergencies. They can phone the landline and the manager will take down the number and alert you. Just to see what it's like not to have a mobile device for 1 week. If you can't do it for 1 week, how about on a poya day? Keeping 9 precepts. The 9th precept is no electronic devices. No iPads, iPhones, no anything like that at all. Try that. It's only 1 day a month. Somebody once said, why does a person have to... It was actually Venerable Yarumimala. They said, why do we have the precept of Abrahmacharya on a poya day? You know, no sexual contact with anybody. He said, because a little bit of restraint. You know, as young men, young women, you know, they like to kiss and have contact and flirt. But one day they say, no, we're not going to do that. They can do it the next day, but that one day, no. They learn restraint, because even when you're married, young men, you'll see a beautiful girl you really like, you get lust up. It's natural. But you've learned how to restrain your urges. As they say, when the blood goes from your head down to between your legs, you don't go stupid. Because you're going to hurt your wife. So you learn some restraint, even on the poya days, by keeping that precept. So you're not addicted to lust. The same if you can put away our mobile devices on the poya days. I don't know if the government could get away with this, but they can turn off all the mobile phone towers on poya days, turn off the electricity, so no one can get a signal. I don't know if that's possible. But, you know, sometimes they stop selling alcohol on poya days. They do that?
They buy the day before.
The day before.
Okay, these are the same old questions of whether a female can be enlightened and...
Yes, there are many females who were enlightened. Today, my delegation from Australia, I was supposed to be going as part of the 7th World Buddhist Summit. Yesterday to Anuradhapura to worship the Mahabodhi tree. And it was a Sri Lankan gentleman a few days ago. He said that
He took his daughter, who's a Sri Lankan born, but she was from Australia, took her to worship the Mahabodhi tree. Because he was a monk, a male, he could actually go up to worship at the Mahabodhi tree. She wanted to go with him, so no, you can't go up, you're a female. He said, what's going on? It was a female who brought the Mahabodhi tree to Sri Lanka. So why can't we go up as well? There's a disconnect there, isn't there?
One last question, which came on email. What is vibhava tanha? Bhava tanha sometimes is explained as wanting to become.
Yeah, this is, first of all, bhava tanha is the craving to be. I've seen this many times when people are really sick, they're ill, and they basically should be dead. But they keep clinging on and clinging on. They'd rather be in pain, in agony, rather than face what they think is the fear of death. The craving to be is one of the strongest. Other people feel that they've had enough, they want to die. Suicidal tendencies, annihilation tendencies. But that is still will. Still doing, it's still craving. You cannot stop samsara because you decide you want to. Many people said, right, this is my last life, I've had enough of samsara, I'm not going to get reborn again. Bad luck, you're going to get reborn again with attitude like that. So, vibhava tanha, craving to end craving. Wanting to end wanting. War to find peace. Never happens. So instead, well, the simile, the Buddha said it's like a dog chasing its own tail. Never catch it. A new simile. It's like trying to lick your elbow. Sounds possible. Try it. Come on, a few of you must have tried it already. You'll be embarrassed. You can't do it. And I heard that. I said, oh, come on. Let's give it a try. You can't. It's impossible. Or like Oliver Twist, trying to eat your own head. You can't do it. Vibhava tanha is an impossibility. Craving to stop craving. So instead, we let go. We let go of all craving. Not more craving. We let go of all craving, and then the process ends. So when you go back home tonight, see if you can prove me wrong. See if you can lick your own elbow. Can't be done. Very good. Okay. So there we go. That's the end for this evening. Hopefully you enjoyed the talks. Hopefully I never said anything which offended you. Sometimes when I tell jokes or funny stories, sometimes people misunderstand. The intention is to teach the Dhamma, to make it interesting, enjoyable, so more people can come to listen to the Dhamma in the future. So you come and it's inspiring, informative, and enjoyable. That means the more people keep coming to the temples. If it is depressing, just telling what you already know, and dull, then people fall asleep, they never want to come back again. So please, make it informative, inspiring, and enjoyable.
Once again, a very big thank you to Bhante for coming and spending time. If any of you want to send more questions, you can always log on to the Western Australia Buddhist Society YouTube channel, and they stream his talks regularly on Fridays and Saturdays.
But most people, their questions don't get actually up. If you made good karma, if your merits are sufficient, then the questions will be answered.
Okay, on that happy note, once again, we conclude this program. And shall we once chant Supatipanno so that Bhante can move from here?
Arthanvita horavakrat adhika kalaya nodanima gevigi. Mesudanama, අද දවසට අවසානයේ සනිටුහන් කරන්නට මේ අවසානය අවසානයක්ම නොවේ. ලෞතර නෛර්යානික ධහමේ පරම නිෂ්ඨාව උතුම් නිර්වාණය අවබෝධ කරගන්නා තුරාවට ඔබ යන මේ සසර ගමනට යම් තරමකින් හෝ සවියක් ශක්තියක් වන්නට ධර්මවාහිනී පදනම නැනස ටීවී නාලිකාව ලර්න් ටීවී සහ ඩයලොග් ටීවී සහයෝගිතාව අපි සූදානම්. අද දවසේ අපත් සමගින් මේ කටයුත්ත සිදු කරන්නට අවසරය ලබා දුන් අපිට ශක්තිය ලබා දුන් සියලු දෙනාටම ස්තුතිය පළ කරන්නට මේ අවස්ථාවේ සමාප්ති සටහන තබන මොහොත අවස්ථාවක් කරගන්නවා. අග්‍රාමාත්‍ය කාර්යාලය එවැගේම ශ්‍රී ලංකා ජනරජයේ ගරු අග්‍රාමාත්‍යතුමන්ට අරලියගහ මන්දිරයේ කාර්ය මණ්ඩලයට අපේ ගෞරවනීය ස්තුතිය පළ කරනවා. එවැගේම ශ්‍රී ලංකා අජාන් බ්‍රහ්ම සමාජයටත් අපේ ගෞරවනීය ස්තුතිය මේ මොහොතේ පළ කරනවා. එවැගේම විශේෂම ස්තුතිය අද දවසේ තිරය පිටුපස හිදිමින් සුවිසල් මෙහෙවරක් සිදු කළ මගේ මාධ්‍ය සගයන් සියලු දෙනාටමත් පළ කරමින් මසූදානම් අද දවසට සමාප්තිය සනිටුහන් කරන්නට. සමාප්තිය සනිටුහන් කරන්නේ බුදුරුවන්ගේ ඒකායන ප්‍රාර්ථනාවක් සමගින්. දස බල සීලක් ප්‍රබවා නිබ්බාන මහා සමුද්ද පරියන්තා අට්ඨංග මග්ග සලිලා ජින වචන නදී චිරං වහසූති. දස බලයන් වහන්සේ නැමැති ශෛලමය පර්වතයෙන් පැන නැගී අමා මහ නිවන නම් වූ මහා සාගරය අවසන් කොට ඇති. ආර්ය අෂ්ටාංගික මාර්ගයේ නම් වූ සිහිල් දිය දහරින් තිබි උතුම් ශ්‍රී මුක බුද්ධ වචන ගංගාව සුවහසක් ලෝසතුන්ගේ සසර දුක් නිවාසනහාලමින් බොහෝ කාලයක් ගලා බස්නාසේක්වා. ධර්ම වාහිනී අපේ ප්‍රාර්ථනාවයයි. ඔබ සැමට තෙරුවන් සරණයි.